Hello and welcome to this collective effort of three free radios in Brussels: Radio Campus, Radio Panique, and Radio Air Libre. We are here on the occasion of the anti-TTIP protests. We are at La Quincaillerie, which is some kind of convergence center in Ixelles, Rue du Viaduct 66. If you want to follow our schedule, you will find it on Indie Media Brussels. It will change from time to time. It is sometimes in English and French. It will also be in Dutch. So if you want to keep informed and if you want to know when you can listen, check Indie Media Brussels. On Indie Media Brussels, you will also find the link to the podcast. So as soon as possible, the broadcasts are made or published as podcasts. So this first broadcast from La Quincaillerie will be in English from 6 to 7. And our first guest is Pia. So can you present yourself, Pia?
My name is Pia. I work for an organization which is based here in Brussels. It's called Corporate Europe Observatory. And normally the work we do is we try to find out how companies influence EU politics in all kinds of areas. And I do that in the field of trade, so I work a lot on TTIP at the moment.
Yes. Many people have heard something about TTIP, but can you explain us, for somebody who doesn't know so much about it, what is TTIP?
Well, TTIP, so the four letters, they stand for Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It's an international agreement negotiated by the EU and the US. They've been negotiating for 2 years now. It's not done yet. The negotiations will take many more years. And while it's called a trade agreement, it has actually not so much to do with trade, so with shipping goods, you know, across the Atlantic. It has much more to do with giving corporations a lot of power in the future to basically stop whatever they dislike, whether that is, you know, strong laws to fight climate change. For example, when you will ask the coal companies, you know, to leave the coal in the ground, that will be very, very difficult with TTIP. It will be very difficult to regulate financial markets. So it is really not so much a trade agreement, but you could call it a corporate big business empowerment agreement, which is why, yeah, more and more people all across Europe are fighting against it.
But I guess this is not just this hasn't started with the TTIP negotiations. This is actually something that has been going on for a long time, because corporations already do have a lot of power in our societies.
Of course, and TTIP is surely not the only problem we are facing. I mean, we see the same trend within the EU with all kinds of internal politics that the EU is pursuing, you know, where, for example, labor rights are rolled back and the environment, you know, also becomes less and less important, while things like competitiveness, so the power of corporations, becomes much more important. And also outside of Europe, the EU has a long history in negotiating trade agreements with the rest of the world, in particular the Global South, that have been very damaging, you know, to societies in these countries, whether it is farmers or also workers in these countries. So it is true, it is a very, TTIP is just, you know, another step in a long development, you know, of giving more power to corporations around the world.
You have been working for some time now on TTIP. You're not alone, but I think you were one of the first who had the chance to spend a lot of time and effort into this. How did it start? When did you or your organization decide, like, now we have to go for this, now we have to concentrate on TTIP?
Well, the idea to have a trade agreement between the EU and the US is quite old. I mean, I would say for nearly 20 years, every now and then you had someone from the political elite or the business sector calling for this, calling for basically a transatlantic market like we have the internal market. But I think they never started negotiations, because it was clear that there would be a lot of resistance and that this deal would be very difficult to push through. And I think this changed when you had the crisis in Europe. So I think the elites saw it as an opportunity to push something like this through, because the left, you know, is weak and is fighting all kinds of other issues. But it's also because of changes in the power constellation in the world, with the rise of China in particular. So it's maybe 3 years ago that we realized, okay, it seems like they're talking a lot about this trade agreement, so maybe it might actually happen. Maybe they might actually launch negotiations. But it wasn't, I mean, so they started in 2013, so 2 years ago, and at the beginning of 2013, I didn't have it in my work plan, so I didn't really expect it to start. And then when it started, I didn't expect that it would become such a big popular issue that so many people would be interested in. But it was shortly before negotiations were launched that we understood, okay, we really have to put a lot of work into this.
And who are the driving forces behind this? Who are the people, or what institutions can decide all of a sudden to start lobbying at the European Commission or elsewhere? That's like, okay, who is initiating this, actually?
Well, it's different forces, I would say. There's no one actor that makes this decision. So as I said, it has been on the agenda of the business sectors on both sides, so in the EU, but also in the US, for many, many years. Businesses basically, I mean, and big corporations in particular, they love free trade agreements because they just give them so much more power. So they have been calling for this for many, many years, and they had allies in the political elite, like the German chancellor, for example. She had raised the issue also again and again. In the end, I think it was very much an initiative of the European Commission that was maybe even pushing more for it than the US government. So it is really a project, you could say, of corporations on both sides of the Atlantic who are, interestingly enough, also working together. So you must not imagine TTIP as something like the US versus the EU. It's really the businesses on both sides, they have the same agenda. They put forward their position papers together. The car industry on both sides, they're working together in pharmaceuticals. So it's corporations on both sides, and they have found a friendly ally, I would say, in the European Commission, which was very happy to take their agenda on board because it fits perfectly well with the agenda of the European Commission.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about the campaign against TTIP? I mean, at one point you realize what is going on, you start doing research, and then you understand what is going on and you want to do something against it, but you are just a person and you're in a small organization, actually, I guess your network, but how do you start the opposition?
Well, there's different levels. I mean, so you have campaigns on the national level in many different EU countries, and I'm living in Germany, so I was quite active in starting the German campaign, which started very early. So that was basically organizations like mine, but also the small farmers organizations, trade unions, environmental groups, who didn't know much about TTIP, but who understood, like, wow, this could be a big threat to everything we have fought for in the last decades. You know, a major rollback of everything we have achieved and stand in the way of things we want to achieve in the future. So we started in Germany, you know, with small meetings. They became bigger and bigger. And then there was a, like, official network formed, and people started doing more research, do events. Then we had the first media reports. And in parallel to these national processes, I think, so in Belgium you had something similar, but it started a bit later. In parallel to that, we also tried to build very early a European movement against this, because it's clear, when you want to fight something in the EU, it's not enough, you know, to just have one member state or two member states. So you really need to work on a European level. So we reached out to all the contacts we had, and we keep doing that. So we're not finished with building this movement. But I think now it is really, since a long time, a real European-wide movement. That is quite well connected. It's loose. We don't have an official alliance or platform. But we work quite well, and it's been quite successful in raising the issue and making it public in country after country.
I think maybe we'll put on some music, because there were too many enthusiastic people here in La Cancaeria. Let me come back to you. Well, the many people have arrived here at Lankakairi. A little bit earlier, there was some kind of wild demo going on, and people were getting arrested. Now they have been freed, and they all come here, and they are, you know, losing pressure, I think, and having a beer and having a good time. But for the time being, it's okay. There's not too much noise. Well, Pia, can you give us some examples, some concrete examples, of the impact TTIP would have on our lives?
Well, they're really manifold. I mean, some people will basically lose their job because what free trade means, it means more competition in certain sectors. This means that, you know, for example, some of the small and medium enterprises will have a hard time. We also know from the experience from previous trade agreements, like the one between the US, Mexico, and Canada, that that wages decrease, so people earn less money. TTIP could also mean things like we have more pesticides left in our food. Pesticides is one important element of the negotiations, and the pesticides laws on both sides of the Atlantic are quite different. For pesticides, the situation is better in the EU. We have, for example, more pesticides that are banned, and we have less traces of pesticides left in food that is allowed. That is something that could change if the pesticide, or at least that's the wish list of the pesticide industry. But TTIP could also mean things like, imagine you live in a city, in a local community that privatized its water system, let's say 10 years ago. And you fight for, you know, that to change because the water has become more expensive and the investor doesn't invest, you know, in the facilities. And then your local government reacts to your campaign and says, okay, let's just buy it back. Let's take it back into public hands. This is actually happening in many cities across Europe, also in the energy sector, where privatizations are being reversed. And with a treaty like TTIP, the investor could just sue your national government because there has been this change, and in the end your national government could be forced to pay, I don't know, 3 billion, 4 billion euros. And the fact that the investor has this right might mean that your local government never does it, you know, because the investor will, when you're discussing this politically, will already threaten with the lawsuit. And we know from many cases around the world where then governments, and rightly so, are just afraid of being sued and never push forward with a change in policy. So this is an example of what I was mentioning before, that TTIP would just give so many new instruments for corporations to fight everything that they don't like. That for many of the changes we are fighting, you know, even if you think about measures to protect the climate, I mean, if you take it, I mean, we know from climate scientists that if we want to, you know, save the planet, we have to make sure that oil, coal, and gas, so the fossil fuels, that they stay in the ground. The thing is, they are already owned by private companies, you know. And so if you force these companies to no longer use them, so to actually keep them in the ground, that means that you massively interfere with their property, which will mean so many lawsuits on the basis of something like TTIP that it will become really, really hard or expensive to push forward with that. So I think whatever struggle you are involved in as a social movement, TTIP will somehow make it more difficult. This is why also so many people from different sectors and who care about different issues are really worried about this agreement.
Mm-hmm. What strikes me is that apparently national law or sovereignty or constitutions, everything will be maybe not thrown away completely, but there will be some force overplaying over it, which just can say no, we don't take care about this, we don't care, we are the boss, and that are the corporations. So I mean, this seems so enormous. How do you think we can win this? How can we win against the corporations?
Yeah. I mean, I really don't want to make people any illusions. Huh? I mean, this is a massive agreement and there are strong, strong interests behind it. I mean, from corporations, from capital, but also political interests. So it will definitely not be easy to stop this agreement. And as you know, stopping something in the EU political system is also very, very difficult because of it's so undemocratic, you know. And even when you win one government, you know, which is already difficult enough, you know, to increase so much pressure on your, let's say, the Belgian government, you know, that it is willing to say no, then it can still hide behind all the other 27 governments and say, oh, we couldn't do anything and the commission put a lot of pressure. So it's really difficult. Nonetheless, I really believe in a scenario that we will never get this agreement. I don't think it's realistic that we will ever see a press conference, for example, where the European Commission and the US government go to the press and say, we're sorry, now we got it, we were wrong, or the negotiations collapsed. That won't happen because there's just too much political and economic capital behind it. Mm-hmm. But what might happen is that we never have this agreement, not in 10 years and not in 15 years, because the negotiations by themselves are actually quite complicated. So the two systems on both sides are very different in several areas. So to make them similar will require really hard compromises on both sides, compromises that are not so easy to sell to the people on both sides. So it's already difficult. And when you have on top of that difficult situation, the situation we have now in Europe with people being in the streets, journalists, you know, digging out all kinds of secret papers, producing critical shows on TV about it, that just makes it even more messy and drives up the price for these compromises. So I think this is really our role, to make it just impossible for politicians, you know, to push this all through in secret and without paying for it. And by raising the price, we can stop this, in the sense of it will never happen. The challenge for us will then be, when do we celebrate, you know, when do we open the champagne? Because it could drag on for many, many years, mm-hmm. and will require a lot of energy and strength to keep on, even in times when it's out of the media and maybe no longer 500,000 in the streets, like in Germany last weekend.
Yeah, I remember, like in the end of the 90s, I forgot the name of the trade agreement, but there have been trade agreements that nobody knew about. Mm. All of a sudden, people started to realize, and then it was kind of abandoned, like you say. But they always come back somehow. So yeah. I guess if we win this one, maybe in 5 years, they will come with something different.
Yeah, that's the frustrating thing when you work on trade, which is why some people also stop doing it after a while, mm-hmm. for your own mental health. it is an agenda that is pushed around the world. And when you manage to prevent one agreement, there is a high risk that it pops up somewhere else. At the same time, you know, in all these struggles, I mean, we managed to prevent certain issues again and again and to defeat the agenda. So for me, it is a very inspiring agenda, because it shows when you actually succeed in building a movement on such an agreement and making the risks known to the people, then they cannot push it through. As soon as you have a resistance, it's really, really difficult to get trade agreements through.
Well, I would like to finish on that, because it is a very positive note. Thank you very much, Pia.
You're welcome. Thanks.
We will come back to you with a bit of news about what happened today. I'm sitting here with Laura. She's also working with Corporate Europe Observatory, but she was also like a contact person for the latest news and news about people being arrested. So, Laura, what can you tell us? What happened today that we don't really know?
Historically, I'll start from the beginning. We were very lucky because there was the Spanish marches. So people that walked from Gibraltar to Brussels, and they arrived today. It was mostly Spanish people, and they came here to denounce a tax haven, which is why they started from Gibraltar. And the idea behind this march was to show that actually governments are not acting on tax havens. And this is a main issue, because obviously what we have now is the richest people in Europe that don't actually pay taxes, while the poorest people have to bear the costs of austerity. So meaning when you're rich, you can just don't pay taxes. And when you're poor, what you have to do is you have less healthcare and less benefits when you're unemployed.
Mm-hmm. But the Spanish marches were not the only people coming from other countries?
No, we were very lucky to have people coming from Greece, from Croatia, from Germany, from Italy, from Greece and Spain. And they came in here to demand another Europe. So we had an encircling. We had different organizations, so farmers, trade unions, environmental NGOs, and every kind of social movements as well that were gathering around the European Summit. And it was supposed to be a blockade, so we were trying to actually divert the route of European leaders and disrupt the Council as much as possible, the European Summit, sorry. And some people were kettled, so they were surrounded by the police for a long time. Some people were directly arrested, but this was Avenue Livingston, which is next to the council, where they were directly arrested and then put into detention. Mm-hmm. And now we know that little by little they're being released, but they have to give their ID. So if they give out their ID to the police, then they'll be able to leave the police station. We also know that there was a blockade next to the parliament. There it was mostly organized by the youth organizations, but also there was Italians, Greeks and Spanish people that took part. And there the blockade lasted for a while, and they talked to the police, and they were only ready to leave the place if the police was ready to actually release people that were detained. So, which is actually at the end what happened. There was a lot of discussions with the police, because obviously, you know, the Brussels police said, as long as you leave the place, we release your friends. And it's just not, of course, what they did. So that's why the blockade lasted for longer. Mm-hmm. And there was also people from the No TTIP camp. They were having their own blockade in the north of the council. And there was some arrests, some kettled. But again, they're being released little by little. So we're hoping for all our friends to be back free tonight, and hopefully without any legal proceedings after that, because so far they give out their ID, but we don't know actually what's going to happen after the police has their ID.
Yes, okay. What do you think about the blockade? Do you think it was a success?
It was a success in the sense that we managed to get some media attention. We also managed to show to the leaders that they cannot just come to Brussels and have their own meeting where they're going to decide on migration and austerity without actually doing anything about it. And it was a success in the sense that it was not just Brussels, it was people from around Europe and mostly people that are directly affected by the policy that are being talked about in the summit. So there's a success in the sense that it shows that when European leaders decide, well, actually everybody agrees with the decisions that they take.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was just the first day?
It was just the first day, of course, because we actually doing this as a 3 days of actions. The idea is tomorrow to have a counter summit, so to have different workshops. The idea is to show that we don't just blockade and we're not here just to... We're not just being angry, we have solutions. So tomorrow it's a day to actually show what kind of solutions we want to put forward, because we want another Europe and we have ideas behind it and there are solutions. And on the Saturday it's a more family thing, it's more like a demonstrations to actually gather. So the 3 days are actually organized so that different kind of people can take different actions. And it's not just actions, it's also showing solutions.
And if you talk about the workshop and the solutions, can you tell a bit more about concretely what will happen tomorrow?
So tomorrow we have a lot of very good conferences. So I hope people that listen will actually be able to join some of them. There's a European Debt Assembly that's organized by CADTM. CADTM has been very active in what's happening in Greece with debt. They will have tomorrow Zoe, who was before the head of the Greek Parliament. She organized a citizens' audit of the Greek debt, so they'll be able to talk about this tomorrow, which means that some part of the Greek debt is actually illegitimate. And this is important to raise, because some part of the debt shouldn't be paid back by the Greek citizens, because part of the debt is not legitimate. And so that's what will be talked about mostly tomorrow in the European Debt Assembly, and this will be 19 Rue Plettinckx in Brussels. But there's also going to be trade unions. They're going to have a workshop on social dumping. Here they will show how the trade unions in Belgium and in the Netherlands actually try to work with labour inspections and with trade unions and with workers to try to make sure that the workers here in Belgium are all treated the same way. So there's no difference between Romanians, Portuguese, Italians or Belgian workers. And as soon as you're on Belgian territory and you work as a worker here, you should all have the same rights. And trade unions are actually very active trying to make sure that inspectors come when actually there's a difference in the way the workers are treated in Belgium. We also have a conference on migration, obviously, that's organized with migrants, and this is quite important to raise. It's not just people here, it's also migrants themselves that organize this conference, and they can show their own solutions to the migration problem. There's also a big demonstration against poverty in Namur, because it's the International Day Against Poverty tomorrow. Peasants as well and farmers are coming together with environmental NGOs to have a conference on climate and agriculture and show how a different kind of agriculture can actually help to save with the climate. There'll be also a conference on CETA, because there's a lot being talked about TTIP, which is the trade agreement between the United States and the European Union, which is currently being negotiated. But there's also an agreement that has been signed but hasn't gone through the European Parliament, and this is CETA. So it's the trade deal between the European Union and Canada, and there'll be a conference tomorrow explaining what exactly it is and how you can mobilize to make sure that this actually doesn't go through the European Parliament. And then at the end of the day, so we have different conferences on different themes, and at the end of the day there's like a convergence of all those themes with a big political meeting, and here we'll present the conclusions and the solutions that we have, and we'll ask politicians, what are you willing to do, because we have ideas, we have solutions, what are you doing? And there'll be also some social movements that'll be there that will show how social movements have already organized, because some of those problems are so urgent that we can't wait for politicians to act. So there's already social movements doing a lot. And again, here we'll have, and during the whole day, we'll have people from Spain, Greece, Italy that'll be here to show what's happening there. So it's a really trying to be European and to show solidarity with the mostly the south of Europe, who's been the most affected by austerity politics. And then on Saturday, we'll have a big demonstration from 12 in front of the European Parliament.
Yeah, it starts with a picnic, no?
It starts with a picnic in front of the Parliament, and then we'll walk around the European Quarter.
Okay, Laura, thank you. You'll be back in French, I'm sure, but this was for the English part. Is there anything more you want to share?
No, maybe just tell people that there's a program online, it's ox15.eu. There's also a lot of social media going on, so if people can't join tomorrow, at least they can follow what's happening online. And obviously, this is open to everyone. This is not going to be technical workshops. It's mostly about showing solutions. So anybody that hasn't heard anything about austerity before or climate can freely come and join and learn a lot.
Yeah, but I also want to share something in the sense that there is not only social media, but today I think we had about 5 hours already of live radio going on. The schedule you will always find on Brussels in the media. It can change, it will be adapted, it will be in different languages, but if you want to stay informed, if you want to listen to us, go to Indie Media Brussels. And also the broadcasts will be put on podcast, and you will find the link also on Indie Media Brussels. So now we will put some more psychedelic music with lots of echo, and around 7 o'clock we will come back in French. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.